You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi.
And I'm Katie Frankowitz. We have an error correction in a story that ran this morning on the fires burning in Spokane, Washington. More than 600 structures burned. Officials are still evaluating how many structures were homes. We regret the error. The structures were destroyed in fires over the weekend. NWPB's Anna King reports from a checkpoint in Spokane on Sunday as survivors waited to see what remained of their neighborhoods.
I'm standing here at a checkpoint at the Spokane Health and Rehabilitation Center. There's people sitting in the grass and near the big signs on cinder block walls, just waiting to hear what's happened to their homes. Everybody is bringing carts, small wheeled carts, and what they can carry in backpacks back out of their neighborhoods. They're not able to go in with cars. And it's really a scene here. There's multiple cop cars with flashing lights blocking the road. Bulldozers, pump trucks, other materials are coming out and going into the neighborhood to help. There's a gas leak down the road. I'm Anna King in North Spokane, Washington.
Around 60,000 people have been evacuated in Spokane. Hundreds slept at the Red Cross shelter downtown. Many were elderly and had to be evacuated from care homes. Donna Diebel is 92. She says the city's transit agency, Spokane Transit, evacuated her.
It's hard. It's hard when we have no way to know how things are going, but we're okay.
A historic weather event with high winds and hot, dry air fanned the flames that burned more than 600 structures. Crews will be assessing damages over the next few days. There are no confirmed reports of deaths or injuries, but officials say that could change. Favorable winds have kept western Washington largely smoke-free this summer, even though northwest wildfires have been burning at exceptional rates. Forecasters say that stretch of luck is about to end. KUOW's John Ryan reports from Seattle.
Smoke from Canada is expected to waft south this morning. Then winds from the east are expected to bring thick smoke from eastern Washington over the Cascades starting tonight. University of Washington scientist Christy Ebi says wildfire smoke is especially bad for your health.
It's not just trees that burn. It's buildings and gasoline stations, asbestos, all kinds of things. It's 3 to 10 times more toxic than the particulate matter that comes out of tailpipes.
The worst smoke is expected in Whatcom and Skagit counties and the Cascade foothills of King and Snohomish counties. When air turns unhealthy, experts say you should limit your time outside and avoid strenuous activities. If you can, close your windows, filter your air, or find a clean air shelter. I'm John Ryan reporting.
Western Oregon is in store for hot weather, smoke, and elevated fire danger this week. The National Weather Service has issued a red flag warning for the southern Willamette Valley today from 1 until 8 p.m. Forecasters say extremely dry conditions, very low humidity, and a steady breeze from the north could contribute to rapid fire spread this afternoon and this evening. That will be followed by several days of high temperatures in the mid to upper 90s for most of the Willamette Valley. Forecasters also say the shift in wind will bring the season's first significant blast of wildfire smoke for western Oregon. The National Weather Service says the smoke should arrive by Monday afternoon and linger in the area through at least Wednesday. You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. Here's Ava Berardi.
As wildfires threaten communities in central Oregon, farmers and ranchers are also worried about fires burning in more remote areas where their crops and their livestock are on the line. OPB reporter April Ehrlich joined a family of ranchers trying to save their cows from a fire heading straight for them.
At a market in Tie Valley, Whitney Nogle is on a brief lunch break from the Grasshopper Fire, burning just east of Mount Hood in Wasco County. For the last few days, she and her family have been wrangling their cows from public lands, which are now on fire.
There's about 150 total up there. We do everything on horseback with dogs. We're old school cowboys.
The Nogles live in Sherman County, but they have a couple of grazing leases on these state and federal lands. That means they can set their cows out to wander across dozens of acres and feed on grasses. So far, Whitney Nogle and her family have caught about two-thirds of their cattle. They've got them penned on a plot of grassland near Ty Valley.
So this is where we're gathering the cattle. There's a pond right over the hill, so we can put them in there to defend them if the fire comes.
Whitney's dad, Pat Nogle, says they've got some people scouting for the remaining cows. There are still a couple of dozen left.
So you go to areas at the time of day you think they're going to be at, water holes, creeks.
To do this work, the Nogles have brought horses, a slew of dogs, and two all-terrain vehicles called side-by-sides.
The side-by-sides, which aren't real cavalry, we use when we're in a hurry like this to spot and maybe see fresh tracks in the dirt, and then we'll go ride that area.
The Nogles and their friends huddle around a firefighter radio, listening for updates, and they're checking online wildfire maps, showing the fire's perimeter inching closer to them. At one point, Whitney hears a mooing sound in the distance.
I just heard it. Yeah.
Heard what?
There's cows right there.
Without another word, everyone flees to their horses and side-by-sides, including Whitney's husband, J.C. Cabral. We pass by a firefighter crew with chainsaws cutting down small trees, but no cows.
Did you hear a cow or a chainsaw?
I swear it was a cow.
When we were on the other side of the tree, the chainsaw does sound like a cow.
It does, yeah.
It's been a long few weeks. They started July helping their friends fight fire on private rangelands closer to home. Now those same friends are helping the Nogles.
Hi, Travis.
Hi, Jesse.
Over the course of the day, more friends show up. So do strangers who got word of some nearby ranchers needing help. They've brought rigs equipped with water tanks and hoses.
Everyone helps everyone. That's the beauty of it.
Jessie Fields and her husband have been by the Nogles' side for the last few days, getting up early to round up cows. For the most part, this day is spent hanging around and chatting, sharing stories, and ribbing each other. But then the winds shift and the sky turns a dark orange. Planes and helicopters fly above. Cows start howling in distress. A couple of guys start packing up their rigs.
What are they doing?
Getting ready.
So when you say you're getting ready, you're getting ready to go look for your cows, right? Or no, you're getting ready to fight fire.
Yeah. The wind holds off, we'll be all right. But
the fire is getting closer. There are still cattle out there, but they found as many as they can find for today.
We'll have to defend what we got. I mean, that's why we've been getting up early in the morning, trying to get what we can. And it's an impossible task to get them all. I mean, it just isn't going to happen.
The crew starts filling up tanks with water from a nearby pond. More ranchers show up. Someone on a dozer digs lines around the cow pen. A few hours later, the winds shift again, and the sky changes back to a dull gray. People start to head home to rest for the night, except Pat. He finds a pillow and a blanket to sleep in his truck, close to his cows. He says they're his livelihood, but they're also more than just that. He has seen them grow up from newborn calves. He has brought some of them into his home to keep them warm in the winter.
You do have insurance on them, but no one wants to see them get burned out. That isn't what we raise them for.
Pat has lost a cow and a calf to fire before. That's what brings him out here now.
Would there ever be a point when you're like, I just got to get out of here?
No. There's a pond over there.
Even at 73 years old, he will wait here, next to his cows, even as the flames appear over the hill's edge. I'm April Ehrlich, reporting.
As the bench fire continues to threaten the Warm Springs Reservation in Central Oregon, people who've lost homes and those still trying to protect them are waiting for clarity about when the danger will pass and what resources they'll have to recover. Jen Biderez reports.
Flint Scott is hunkered down in a motel room in Madras, trying to figure out what's next.
The plans is to keep staying in the fight.
He is Wasco, Warm Springs, and Paiute. His family was forced to flee their homes on the Warm Springs Reservation last week.
My adrenaline was going and I couldn't even, I had to be calm. I was like, be calm. And so it got to the point like, okay, we need to prioritize this kid. What's important?
The 49-year-old says he grabbed photos, heirlooms, and tribal beadwork from his house. He says he and his family raced out as police drove through, yelling for everyone to evacuate.
Well, you couldn't even see, you couldn't even breathe, and there was white and black smoke everywhere. You couldn't even see 10 feet in front of you.
That night, they slept outside of a friend's house because it was already full of other people who'd evacuated. Flames had closed down the highway, forcing many to shelter in place. The next day, they went to a shelter they'd been told was open on the reservation. But Flint's 22-year-old daughter, Cajun Scott, says they found the doors locked. They slept outside again.
I was just thinking about the houses up there. I was thinking, like, if my family's home burns down that I'm staying in, where am I going to go?
Firefighters managed to save the family home she lives in. But her dad, Flint Scott's place, and the family home where he grew up both burned to the ground. The family is unsure of what emergency assistance they'll get from the tribes or other governments, and they don't know when they can return to the home that survived.
We haven't been as fast forthcoming on some of the services that they need.
Edward Henderson is the Treasury Secretary and CEO of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. He says the impacts of this fire will be felt for years to come, financially and emotionally, from the loss of First Foods to revenue from timber sales being decimated.
It's the land, the fish, the animals, all of it is all interconnected. We see it as interconnected. You know, some outside might say, well, it's just the timber, it's just the forest, it'll grow back. Well, I mean, we live here, and you know, we're stewards of this, and we're supposed to take care of it.
I'm so sorry for all of that. The Warm Springs Tribal Council did not allow me to interview people at a shelter or give OPB permission to visit homes on the reservation, which is governed by a sovereign nation. They say the ban is to respect tribal members during the crisis, but residents we interviewed elsewhere and by phone say they are concerned about the public not realizing what is unfolding. Not enough resources, extended power outages, and boil water notices. On Thursday, tribal officials warned residents they could run out of water altogether because of a cracked pipe. On the outskirts of the nearly 640,000-acre reservation, I reached tribal member Shanna Johnson by phone while she took a brief rest in her car at the end of another very long, very hard day.
Right now, I'm kind of a little bit relaxing now that we have electricity, because I think we've been about, 7 days without electricity?
For the last week, her family has spent day and night fighting the fire around their sprawling ranch at the southern edge of the reservation, trying to protect homes and hundreds of animals, cows, horses, cats, and dogs. A dozen family members live in homes on the property, from ages 3 to 75.
It's not like for us, we can just pick up and move, you know. We pretty much decided that we were going to all stay and, you know, make sure that our animals were okay.
Without electricity, she says they couldn't operate their wells for water. Their refrigerated food quickly spoiled.
It was a struggle, you know.
They ate just once a day.
In the mornings when you wake up, you can't even see in front of you because it's so smoky.
One of her nephews went to the hospital when he had trouble breathing. Then he couldn't get back home because the roads had closed. That's in part why Johnson says nobody else has left. But there's more to it.
We take care of the springs. We take care of the creek. We take care of the animals. We all were raised here since, you know, all our life. It's a part of us, this land, and we're a part of it.
She estimates she has about 2 weeks left of hay to feed the livestock, and she's not sure how she'll get more or how they'll get through the rest of summer. Jen Bitus reporting.
You're listening to KMUN.
The Trump administration is proposing sweeping changes to federal funding rules. This could impact how people receive their science news. KNKX's Anna Marie Yanni has more.
Federal grants are used for many things at research organizations, including getting their science out to the public. This proposal would limit funds for communicating findings to the press and place restrictions on, quote, issue advocacy. Lauren Quinn is with the National Association of Science Writers. She works with researchers to share their findings with wider audiences.
So I think it'll be a lot harder for people in my role to get our work done and to get that science out to the public. taxpayers are the people who pay for federal research to be done. So they deserve to know what they're paying for.
Washington Governor Bob Ferguson's office is speaking out against the proposal and its funding restrictions. He says it will add additional layers of political review to federal grants. The Office of Management and Budget says the revised guidance will ensure American tax dollars are not wasted or misused. Ferguson's office says the OMB intends to implement the final proposal by October 1st. I'm Anna Marie Yanni reporting.
Environmental groups have failed to prevent a logging project it says is cutting down too many hardwood trees west of Ashland. Jefferson Public Radio's Roman Battaglia reports.
A federal judge ruled against a preliminary injunction over the Ashland SOS project. The Federal Bureau of Land Management is removing dead or dying fir trees to reduce the risk of severe wildfires. Applegate Siskiyou Alliance Executive Director Luke Riediger says the BLM is logging a lot more fire-resistant hardwood trees than they originally claimed.
We're finding that despite the BLM claims that they would be promoting or enhancing a hardwood habitat, we're finding over 80% of the hardwood trees are removed.
The BLM did not respond to a request for comment. The judge said the BLM did enough to consider the environmental impacts, and the need to reduce wildfire risk means the project should continue as planned. The lawsuit will move forward, but now the environmental groups need to prove their case before the projects can be stopped. I'm Roman Battaglia in Ashland.
Congressman Dan Newhouse, who represents Central Washington in the U.S. House, is retiring. His district is a longstanding Republican stronghold, and now 11 candidates say they want to take his seat. NWPB's Courtney Flatt has more.
For over 30 years, Republicans have represented Washington's 4th District, covering most of Central Washington. Chris Vance is the former chairman of Washington State's Republican Party. He thinks it's likely a Republican will end up representing Central Washington, but he says,
there's more to being in Congress than just being an ideological warrior, getting up and giving fiery speeches. It's about delivering for your community, and Central Washington needs the federal government's help.
In Washington State primaries, the top two candidates advance to the general election. Political scientists say the large number of Republicans running could split the vote. That could mean a Republican and a Democrat could make the November ballot. I'm Courtney Flatt.
Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Virginia Governor Abigail Spanberger announced July 31st that she has restored the voting and civil rights to over 66,000 formerly incarcerated citizens since she took office in January. Virginia is only one of three states where withholding those rights remains in the state constitution. Spanberger said in a statement, "I'm proud that, after contending with my predecessor's efforts to deny Virginians their fundamental rights, we have restored the rights of more than 66,000 Virginians who have served their time. These Virginians deserve the right to use their vote, make their voices heard, and be recognized as contributing citizens to our Commonwealth and country," unquote. Virginia, Iowa, and Kentucky have provisions in their constitutions which withhold voting and civil rights even after paroled citizens have returned to society. All three states empower the governor to restore those rights. If approved, a November ballot measure, question 3, would amend Virginia's constitution to automatically restore those rights upon release. The Reverend Cozy Bailey, president of the NAACP Virginia State Conference, said in a statement, "Voting is a fundamental right of citizenship, and every Virginian who has returned to their community deserves that right fully restored." We've linked to the governor's statement, local reporting by the Virginia Mercury, and each state's policy at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.